Welcome to Drunk on Comics, episode number 204. Today we have a very special interview with Bob Sally, creator and writer of Salvagers.
Yes, he talked to us at length. I mean, he is a man of many words.
And letters.
Yes. And talking about the writing process, giving lots of good advice for people who are trying to come up with comic books, as well as obviously talking about his own book as well.
Yeah, Salvagers is a great sci-fi comic series that he's trying to build a whole universe around, and he's working on Volume 2 currently. Really excited to see where this goes in the future.
Yes, we learned a lot from him, because as I said, we didn't have to ask many questions. He just kind of talked.
That's the best part about interviewing writers, though. They will talk. It makes it so easy on us.
Yeah, so definitely a great episode. So sit back, relax, enjoy Drunk on Comics, episode 204, interview with Bob Sally.
It was fun taking those classes, but then afterwards you're like, well, never use that again.
Until now.
Yeah. The horrid day that it comes back to bite me.
Yep.
Just get put on the spot in 3 years, just gone like that.
Makes me wonder what my tuition went for. Comic book writing.
Yes.
Ooh. Yeah. When you're in college, you're like, I'm going to write the great American novel. Comic books.
Well, now's the time, right?
Yeah. No, I love writing comic books. I've talked to people about writing, you know, because I wrote prose, like short stories and poems and all that. And I hit writer's block, and that's how I got into comic book writing. And I've never thought about going back until my artist and I were just at Cheyenne Comic Con, and he was saying, he was like, have you ever thought about doing short prose of scenes that would fit into the whole storyline that you're building now? And I was like, actually, that's a really good idea.
That is a really good idea. Then you could release it as like a compendium to go along with
exactly
that. Just give you more in-depth
so insight. I'm thinking about it, you know. Nice. I haven't written prose in, I mean, I've started writing, so what's that, 2016? I started writing this, like conceptualizing it and writing it and all that in 2004, so it's been 12 years now since I've written anything that's not comic book related.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome, though.
But it's, you know, when I think as a writer, if you're going to take on like a certain type of medium in writing, you want to know how to do it. You want to do it well. You don't want to do it half-assed. So in that 14 years, I've also been trying to teach myself how to write comic books, reading comic books, learning, you know, how to be a better comic book writer, learning flow, learning beats and all of that. So, you know, I tell people, I'm like, oh, it takes about 14 years to get half decent. You know, I mean, I wouldn't even say that, you know, I still have ways more, you know, way more places to go with this. But, you know, I at least now know the shittiness of my writing in the beginning, you know, and what not to do.
Well, at least you have that self-actualization. That's always good.
It's important.
I suck.
But you know what? I think it's important to know that you suck and to admit that you suck, because that's when you start realizing, like, okay, how do I break this down and build it better? So, and I think that, you know, you talk to a lot of people that never really want to admit that, you know, they look at what they do and they think, you know, this is great. And, but they never really, I always, like, I have editors now, like, I have two editors that I give it to, and, you know, and they don't candy coat anything. You know, I'm like, because I've told them, I'm like, look, if it sucks, I want to know that it sucks. Like, don't, you know, be constructive about it. But, you know, I don't think that I'm great by any means. So I want to know what's wrong with what I'm writing so I can make it better. Where I think some people, when they, you know, when they write, they're afraid to look at that. They're afraid to uncover, you know, where they need to improve. So maybe it might take them longer to improve.
That's what, the road to success is sucking a little bit less.
Exactly. You know, you always want to make, today I sucked less. You're not any better, you just sucked less.
That's a good life philosophy.
Yeah.
I have to give you props. This is probably the best start to an interview that we've ever done. You are just in. You're just in the mode from the start.
Wait, should I be recording?
Are we recording already?
You better have been recording.
Yeah,
that.
I have been.
Oh yeah.
So I'm used to, like, when you do a podcast, you know, like you get in there and you're like, hey, how you doing? And then you talk, and then for a minute, like, somebody might be like, hey, listen, I'm gonna stop you right there because this is good stuff, and we're gonna record it, and we'll get back to that. So I'm glad that, you know. It's great, refreshing to be like, hey, hit the ground running.
Why not? Yes. We've learned after fucking up enough times to actually just record everything at this point. So
yes,
and then hopefully not delete it on accident.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I've done podcasts where it was an hour long podcast, and 15 minutes after we were done, I got a text message saying like, hey, can you jump back on? We didn't record that.
Oh,
and I'm just like,
that's happened to us.
We did that to Dan Doherty once and felt really, really bad. So.
We've learned.
Dan Doherty does not call you back.
No, he still likes us somehow.
He would be a guy that would be like, yeah, sure.
That was our moment of, next time we're going to suck a little bit less at this.
Yep.
There you go.
Yep.
Damn, we promise.
Tony was scared to talk to him for a year after that. He only recently at Motor City was like, Dan, I'm still really sorry about that. And Dan's like, ah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, you know, that's like Dan, like those guys, everybody out on the West Coast are so cool. I'm on the East Coast. I'm in Boston. You know, starting out, you don't travel far when you start out because, you know, you figure like it's not worth me paying airfare and all this to go to Chicago or, you know, go to Denver. So you really stick to your neck of the woods. And, you know, so I did Boston. I would do surrounding areas in Boston and you'd meet the same people. And the people around here are amazing. They're really nice people. But when you go out to the Midwest, they're like, where you almost be like, are you fucking with me? Are you guys laughing behind my back or something? Because you're so super nice, and then as you get to know them, you're like, no, these people are just. And then you start looking at the people that you know on the East Coast, and you're like, you guys are a bunch of assholes. You know? And I'm included in that. I'm like, I'm like, you know, when I talk to people that are in the like Midwest, I'm like, am I an asshole? Because I just, you guys are so nice. So yeah. It's refreshing. I was just out at C2E2, and God, I mean, like, it's so nice. People are so nice out there, and I think it's just like a different way of living life. You know, like East Coast people are very fast. They're very, inward. You know, it's like, what am I working on? What am I working on? And out in the West Coast or Midwest, people are like, what are you working on? And I hope that I took something from C2E2 to, you know, put that into my own style and, you know, my own network of people that I know out here in the Northeast, because one of the things that I'm doing now in the Boston area is I'm trying to find all the creators that are in and around this area. And I want to start our own little community. And we've been doing that. I got Jenny Wood, Josh Dahl, Johnny C, Andy Arnett, like all these people that are creators who I feel like we know each other and we talk online, we talk on social media. I'm thinking like, you know, we're not far from each other. So why not, you know, grab a bite to eat with each other and have a drink with each other and just communicate. And we don't, they talk comics, but just get to know each other on more than just a flat social media basis, but, you know, become friends. And we did that. Jenny Wood had she recently had a little art exhibit at Avery, getting that name wrong, but it was in Jamaica Plain, and I jumped at it. I was like, you know, it was on a weekday, but I was like, I want to put myself out there. I want to support the people that are in this area that are doing what I'm doing and become tighter with them because of what I saw out in the Midwest, in Chicago. And you know, they're doing it the right way out there. And I just want to kind of carry that over to the East Coast. And hopefully that positive, you know, that positive attitude spills over into, you know, the network out here, and everybody becomes friendlier.
Well, that's what I love, going to conventions and what we call it our con family, but a lot of local artists from the Midwest will obviously do the same circuit around here. We'll go doing some interviews. We'll obviously interview them to help plug some of their stuff, try to get some other interviews with other people. They may have connections to some other people to talk to. And besides like a business standpoint of, you know, artists and writers are there to be making money and we're there to kind of just be doing interviews and podcasts, it's all, you know, synergy. And with that being said, though, beyond even the working part, we've created true friendships with some of these people that even outside of like talking about their comic books and what they're doing or their published companies or anything like that, we like to hang out. We like to go to the bar after the con and be like, let's shoot the shit. What the hell, you know, you like hockey, you like this or that, let's talk. And that's what I, as kind of what you're saying, that I've always loved about the community that I've been a part of since going to conventions. And it's cool if you're getting that started over on the East Coast as well, because there needs to be more of that.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, I keep referring back to C2E2 because it was my first time out there, and it was amazing experience. Like you said, comic book creators go to these conventions to sell their product, to sell their comics, and to, you know, I always say, like, I'm not out there to make money. I'm out there to sell what I have because I want to build my fan base. But also, you want to network and you want to get to know other people. And, you know, I'm, you know, going to be in two anthologies because of people that I met. It wasn't any work that I did searching for anthologies to submit to. It was people that I know now who either posted something or recommended it. And then I submitted it to, and I never would have done that had I not, you know, gone out there and put myself out there. And I always say, like, you know, I know Dirk Manning says it too, and a lot of people say it, like, you got to be cool. You know, like, you can't be a dick in this industry because, you know, you're going to be out on an island by yourself, and it's lonely out there. I mean, it's already lonely enough being a creator in this comic book industry. But if you don't have the support of the comic book creators network, you know, and it's such a vague word or a phrase to say because there's so many different networks, and you know, it's, I know people that are just, you know, getting involved in creating, and they talk about it. They're like, I want to be a part of that network. And it's a slow process. You know, it's a party in your high school. You're the new kid, you know, and everybody knows about this party, or most of them do. And you want to get to be invited to that party, and you need to, you know, you can't just walk up to the door and expect them to let you in. You need to kind of do your thing, and you got to kind of like get to know people. And I know it sounds so cheesy, but it is. I mean, that's the way it is. Like, you know, when creators respect other creators when they're doing the work, you know, when I see other creators busting their ass, like, I tip my hat to them. And I am like, I know what it's like to have to put in those long hours, to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and write, or stay up till 1 o'clock in the morning writing, or to learn how to do social media, or even like live, like, you know, Facebook Live just went live, or, you know, whatever. And, you know, and I think so many people were like, what the fuck do I do with this? And I was one of those people. I'm like, shit, like, I have to do this. I was telling my wife, I'm like, you know, it's a new thing. I have to at least try it. Like, and I didn't want to, I don't like to put my face out there. I don't like to get on camera, and, but you need to adapt to it, and you need to do it. And it's helped me build a new, like, you know, a stronger fan base, and it's helped me network with people. But to see people go out there and do those things, you respect that. And it's great to, you know, it's great to see other people busting their ass, you know, creating, because you know that that's their passion. They know this creating concept or comic book creating thing. Nobody really, if you understand it, you know, like, you're not going to get rich doing it. You know, it's the likelihood of you making millions and millions of dollars is very small. So people that are doing it know that. The people that have been doing it for a long time know that. So you know that they're doing it just because they're passionate about it. And you have to, you know, if you are like that, you have to tip your hat to that, you know, that work ethic of doing something just because it's your passion. And, you know, the payoff might be very little, but you do it anyway.
Well, that's what, I mean, besides just the passion, I mean, there's the time for coming up with the story, waiting for the artist to get done with it, packaging, you know, everything. And then you're not even done yet because you're still going to conventions to try to, you know, sell it to a wider audience. And
oh, yeah.
It's a full-time job in and of itself, besides just the doing stuff at home and for even an art, you know, perspective, you know, them doing a couple pages per day, and then, oh, it's the weekend, need to go to this con and stuff. So it can be tough. I mean, even for us who, you know, we like to do this podcast, and it sometimes can seem like a full-time job. We still try to make it just part of our lives, but it's part-time. But time to go to conventions is, like, hard to find, and I was kind of wondering your take on that. Like, how many cons do you usually go to a year, and where do you seek them out, or which ones do you decide to go to?
I mean, I like, again, when I first started out, I was going to, I would definitely do Boston Comic Con because that's the big one in my area. You know, Rhode Island is probably a little more than 45 minutes away, maybe an hour away. So that, I you know, that was another big one. But there was a lot of smaller ones, like Super Mega Fest. There's Massive Con. There's, you know, Connecticut. There's Hartford. So I was doing those. And then you start realizing, like, you're seeing the same faces because the people that, you know, travel. I mean, you're seeing a lot of new faces, but you are seeing the same faces. And you feel like, you know, I'm only hitting this region. So, you know, this past year I got invited to Cheyenne Comic Con. Phil Matotes, he runs the Loft Comics and Collectibles store in Cheyenne. And, you know, from AZ Power Girl, Karen Nicole, she introduced myself and Phil, and he read my book. He liked it. So I gave him my book, and he, you know, amazingly enough, he, you know, brought me out there. And it was a small con, but it was great to be out in a different area where not a lot of people knew me, and just grabbed like a whole new fan base from this certain region, you know, that Denver, you know, Denver, people travel all over the place out there in the Midwest, which is amazing. East Coast people are like, I'm not driving 300 miles unless it's for a long weekend. But, you know, people were all over. You know, I met people from all over. So now, and then I did, you know, C2E2. I'm looking, you know, I have a baby on the way. So this year has been kind of slow for me. But 2017, I'm looking to kind of do different regions, you know, and it is tough because your weekends are, you know, having kids. I mean, every time you go away for a con, you know, I just worked a 9-to-5 job. Then, you know, you take a Friday off, you leave Thursday night to go to the con. Then you're there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you come home Sunday night, you're back to work, and you feel like you just missed, you know, 2 days where that's like really good family quality time with your family. And you just missed that because you were doing a con, but it's a necessity. You have to do it. And so you do try to space them out, and you try, and in thinking about that, you know, and for 2017, you know, I want to hit new cons. I want to hit, like, I would like to go to Chicago again. I would like to go to Denver. I've never been to Denver, but I hear that's a great con. I would like to go to Baltimore. So you know which ones you want to hit, and then you got to kind of get a calendar down because a lot of these cons are like back to back, and that's tough to be like, all right, well, I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to do Boston this weekend, and then the weekend after that, I'm going to do Baltimore. You really have to pick and choose which one you do because you just can't. It's I mean, as a family man and somebody that, you know, you can't just keep going every weekend. So you really need to figure out a schedule and look at a calendar. So, yeah, I mean, I am looking to go back to the Midwest, and, you know, always Boston is always my hometown one that I feel like I want to hit. I'm from Philadelphia. So, there's the Greater Philadelphia Con, and that's one that I definitely want to do next year. It's in April. So it is spreading yourself out, but also spreading the weekends out so you're not, you know, you don't feel like you're just on the road and missing everything. And, you know, that's the single people, like, they have that advantage that they can just get out there and do it. But, you know, when you have a family, you want to be there for them.
So have you ever thought about when the kids get older, kid? Is this your first kid that's on the way?
No, this is my second. I have a three-year-old right now.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Are you looking forward to the day when you can just bring them along with you?
Oh, yeah. You know, we went to there's a little convention in just outside of Boston, Northeast Comic Collection. I don't know. I'm sorry. Gary Summers is if you listen to this, Gary, sorry, free parking. But it's Northeast Collectibles Comic Con. It's at the Shriners Convention, but it's an awesome little convention. There's some comics in it, but it's very like you know, collectibles, toys, and all that. And I brought my daughter there. She was dressed as Pikachu.
Oh,
I mean, she was having a blast. You know, she's running around and she just knew it. Like, you could see, like, she's going to have this little performer in her. But, you know, they were doing an anime on the stage. They were doing like bring all the animes up. And, you know, this one guy was dressed as, you know, Pikachu's owner with the ball. And he was like, bring her up. And she was on stage, and they were taking pictures, and you could just see her face. She was just loving it. So, yeah, I mean, I can't wait to have them there. And, you know, you fantasize, I'm always like, I'm going to be working my table, and I can just imagine, like, my kids coming over dressed as whoever they're dressed as, asking me, like, Dad, can we have some money for soda or this or that? They're like, yeah, here you go. And
they're going to be con
kids. But I see, like, you see creators all the time. They bring their kids in there. They sit down. Their kids draw. And somebody always comes by and, you know, buys their little crown drawing. And but it, I am looking forward to that. That'll be, you know, if anything, I've always said the one of the main reasons that I work so hard at this is because I want my kids to see that anything that they want in life, if they work hard enough at it and they want it enough, they can get it. And that's, you know, that's one of my many driving factors in this is I want my kids to see that there's no limit to what they can do.
That's great advice for anyone, really.
Yeah.
So let's talk about.
Figure it's been 20 minutes. We should probably actually say we're talking to Bob Sally, the creator of Salvagers.
Let's talk about this project that you've passionately been working on for how many years now?
Well, I started conceptualizing it in 2003. When I hit some writer's block, my professor told me, he was like, just write anything. So I had a piece of paper and I just started writing down character names, what their, you know, job was. And I started thinking of this, not just a crew, but it was a company, Harrier Salvage, that cleaned up space. You know, they cleaned up, busted up battleships that were left out floating in space. And so they were like the leader in intergalactic cleanup, salvage and rescue. So I started, you know, I started going down the line with characters, pilots. And at first there was like, you know, I think that there was like 8 characters that were on the ship. But I knew, like, writing, I'm like, that's going to be tough to introduce all those characters. So I broke it down to 4, you know, obviously thinking if it's in the future, you have a lot of machines that can do the work for you. So I said, all right, we need a captain, Captain Bill Ronick. We need a pilot, Tegan Ray. We need a demolition guy who can bust everything up and tear everything apart. That's the big guy tier. And then you need a tech guy who, you know, knows all the ins and outs of everything, and that's Brigby. So, and then the ship has its own artificial intelligence called Avery, which is artificial vehicular resource intelligence. And then it kind of helps them out with everything. It's kind of a cheat. You know, you can have, if you have any questions that need to be answered right away, it's like, hey, well, you know, the ship told us.
And that's definitely like a sci-fi go-to.
You know, you would imagine that somewhere along the lines, artificial intelligence is going to help us out. So
yes, and then maybe go evil.
Yeah, well, hopefully. Otherwise, we've been lied to. But yeah, so I started writing the characters before I wrote anything. And originally, they were all human. And then as I kept going on and on with conceptualizing it, I thought, you know, like, I want them to kind of stand out. So I felt if I had all humans, it's to the eye, you wouldn't really be able to, it wouldn't stand out. It wouldn't like pop. So George Acevedo and I, the artist on Volume 1, and the guy who, you know, really helped me build it to where it is, I told him what I wanted. I told him kind of what I was looking for, and he and I kept going back and forth. Like, he would draw something, I'd be like, change this, until finally, like, he would give me something, and I'd be like, that's it, that's the character. And in my mind, like, I kept thinking, like, you know, at some point, like, I want these characters just to be iconic. Like, Darth Vader is iconic. If you look at Darth Vader, even if you've never seen Star Wars, you know that that's Darth Vader.
Mm-hmm.
So in my dreams were like that. I wanted it to be simple enough, you know, where they were really cool looking aliens, but they were simple enough that they could be like this, these iconic characters. And, you know, we're not there yet, but, you know, we're working on it. So once I had the characters down, that's when I started kind of getting to know them. Like, what's their personality? And again, this is like before the story was even written. This was years of just developing characters and characterization. So when I started writing the character, the plot and the story, I would know what they would do, what they wouldn't do, what, like, you know, what their actions would be. And then I finally got there and I wrote the story and it sucked and I threw it away. And I wrote another one that sucked and I threw it away. And until we finally got to one where I'm like, okay, this is a good introductory story. And, you know, there was 4 characters. So I had these pirates, which we're getting into in Volume 2, but I'm like, okay, now I have a villain that I have to kind of explain, like, who they are and all that. So, again, I threw it away and I started writing again, and I took the pirates out and I made them get onto a ship where some things go wrong and some robots go berserk, because I figured if the antagonist in this Volume 1 was, you know, berserker robots, I didn't have to give any background on them, and, you know, and I could focus on the four characters that I wanted to develop. And I thought that that worked well. And then it also really gave me, by the time that they were developed in Volume 1, now I can get to the real story that I wanted to do, is Volume 2, where I have these pirates coming. And now the four characters have been established, so now I can focus on the villains and what their motivation is. So basically, I know that I just went off on like a little bit of a tangent.
Oh, no. But we love tangents.
Sorry about that.
Tangents are the best.
Yeah. Perfect.
The story, like I said, my tagline or my log line or my pitch to when I'm at a convention is, you know, after the real battle, after the big battle has been won and the good guys, you know, defeated the bad guys and the credits are rolling, that's when my crew has to suit up and their story begins of cleaning up the mess. And they're out in a hostile galaxy trying to clean it up and make a buck, and they have to go up against pirates, militias, and all sorts of dangers in the galaxy who also want what they're going after, but you know, and also that they have to work together and not to kill each other on the ship. So it's a crew. Like they're not rebels, they're not explorers, they're just blue collar workers out there trying to make a buck, and just like us, we're looking to retire on some beach somewhere. That's what they're doing. And you can imagine if your job is to clean up space, you know, things probably haven't gone so well for you. You know, there's probably so many better jobs out there, but you are cleaning up a mess in space. So
right,
which as the story goes on, we're going to build on the characters, yeah. And you're going to see their, you know, you're going to slowly see why they are on that ship and, you know, what choices they made to bring them to where they are and how they're all together now.
Well, I thought you did a really good job, because all four of the characters obviously are there for a reason, and I thought you did a really good job of, like, kind of hinting at their backstories a little bit. Like, one of them was in the military at one point. One of them is on parole.
Yeah, the pilot is on parole.
Right. And then we got Brigby, of course, who obviously owes a lot of money to to people, and he's done some stuff along the way. So I thought you did a really good job building in Volume 1 what you did to make people want to get further into the backstories of each one of these characters.
And that's the part where I'm just learning how to write a comic book, because, you know, I'm always like, did I not give enough? Did I give too much? Like, I constantly think, like, I didn't give enough. So now in Volume 2, I'm like, am I compensating by giving more? But that was the goal. The goal was that by the time you're done Volume 1, you know enough about the characters where you want to learn more about it. It's called, you know, peeling the onion, not giving everybody the core of it, but slowly giving a little bit, and, you know, hopefully people are interested in all the characters where they want to see more of them.
Yeah, I think you did a really good job. I'm intrigued.
Yeah,
for sure.
Reminds me of, like, the old school sci-fi stuff I used to watch with my dad on TV all the time. So that's great. It's like my childhood again in the comic book. So that's awesome.
I like hearing that. And thank you.
Well, and when you were talking earlier about how you started with them as all humans and you changed your mind, I think you made an excellent decision, because one of my favorite parts is when you were doing the backstory with Brigby and why they were on this mission in the first place, not just to salvage for their jobs, but to, like, get him out of trouble, and they cut his arm off.
Yeah.
And then it turns into its own little creature after the arm. That, I mean.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that part too. I was like, that is gross, sick, awesome.
I know.
Never thought of that. Like,
I know. It just, it tells a lot about his species without even, like, having to say anything.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, and he's, I mean, I think that volume, that issue too, when I talk to people, like, everybody loves Brigby, because I think everybody loves that guy in their life, you know, that the guy that is just a total fuck up, but you love him, you know. He's the guy, like, you would say you either love him or hate him, but if you give him enough time, you're probably gonna love him,
right? They're always the endearing.
Everyone has that idiot friend. So.
Everyone has a Tony.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, guys.
Just kidding, buddy. We love you.
So there's one point in the first issue with the defense robots, and, you know, there's the two type. There's the standing up ones, or like the dog like cat like ones.
Yeah.
And when one of them has some knife claws come out, like, and it goes schnick. Like, I was wondering, is there, like, do you know, because this is just, like, randomly coming to my head when I was reading it, Is there like a copyright on the Wolverine schnicked word or like?
You know what's funny is I didn't write that. I didn't write that in there, like the sound effects in there, mm-hmm. and the letterer put that in there, and I was like thinking the same thing. I didn't say anything, but I'm like, I was like, that's the Wolverine schnick. Yeah. You know, like where if you read a comic book and it was like a Spider-Man comic book, and the last page was just like darkness, and you just saw the sound effect schnick. Mm-hmm. Immediately you're like, well, that's Wolverine.
Yep. Yeah.
So again, it's the learning process. You know? Next time I'll come up with a, I'll be like, no, let's make it like Schneer.
Yeah. Well, you could always be like, well, he's from England and doesn't know, so.
Yeah. Oh, so you must know HD.
Well, you know, I like to do my research before interviews. But I was actually, your team on the first volume is from all over the place.
Yeah. You got East Coast, West Coast, France, and England, so, which was great. I mean, that was, you know, it's when we first did it, it was going to be black and white. And we found DeSica, who was up for coloring it. And we were like, okay, let's do it. And then HDE, the best guy that I cannot sing this guy's praises enough, but it was so funny because I was posting like pages on Facebook, on the Facebook page, the Salvagers series. If you go to Facebook and you put in Salvagers, you'll probably see our little black and white logo. But we were posting pictures on it, and George did the lettering. And one of the things George did tell me, he was like, I've never lettered a comic book. And I'm like, yeah, it's fine. And as you're when you're in the beginning stages of comic book creating, you're like, who gives a shit about lettering? All people need to do is read it. You know, like it's, but when it, so then HD saw this and he contacted me and he was like, listen, he's like, your pages are making me shake. I would just like to do one myself just to show you, you know, what good lettering can make it look like. And when he did that, my whole mindset changed. And I would tell people all the time, I'm like, a pro tip is do not skimp on lettering. Lettering is so important, and it totally gives your book a way more professional look to it. So I was wrong. You know, I was always like, lettering, schmettering, you know, just put some letters on it. And having HD do it, he totally sold me on the power of lettering. And then you really see that coloring, lettering, every aspect of putting a book together is important. It's not just the line work. You know, you can have really good line work, but bad coloring. You could have really good coloring on bad line work, and it's not, you know, it all kind of mixes together. So, yeah, lettering is very important to do and to do it right. And if anybody's looking for a letterer, go to HD. He's amazing.
Letterers are the unsung heroes of the comic book
world.
They really are. I mean, I only know a few letterers, but probably because I trust the HD so much. And he doesn't just do the lettering for me. He does all like he'll put it all together for Comixology. He'll put it together for print. So he's really like a one-stop shop. So I'm like, and when you get comfortable with somebody in this, you know, in this creation process, when you get comfortable with somebody, you don't want to use anybody else. You have that, you have that rhythm with each other where I could give him something and I don't even need to say anything because he knows what I want him to do with it. So, but yeah, I mean, there's great letterers out there, but definitely don't skimp on lettering.
So with your team being like so like distant from each other, have you got the chance to meet them in person, or has it all been email correspondence and Skype?
Yeah, it's been all that. I mean, so with Volume One, I've talked to George on the phone. We've done podcasts together. We were texting all the time. I still text with George now. Like, I mean, he's always going to be somebody very close to me because I couldn't have done this without him. When I first started out, I had no idea how to find an artist, and he was, you know, he jumped on with me, and I totally appreciate him for that. But I never met him. We've never met face to face. Obviously, I've never met HD or DeSica, but my new artist, Chris Jevona, he is from Salt Lake City, and he and I both did Cheyenne Comic Con together, which was an amazing experience, just sitting at a booth for 3 days with your artist. It's just so priceless. I mean, to get on to that personal level, like we went out, we'd have breakfast in the morning together. You know, afterwards, we'd, you know, go out and have dinner and some drinks together. And just constantly, we were, you know, talking about our personal lives, but really bonding on the process of creating this comic book. And I think... when you have a new artist or a new art team, which my, you know, besides HDE, I have a new artist and I have a new colorist, and it's so, you kind of get the creaks of a house, you know, you're like, it's settling in. And, you know, with George and I, when we did the first one, I mean, it took us like 3 years to do issue one, and that was only 22 pages, but that was, you know, it was a lot of stop and go. When I did the Kickstarter for volume two, part one, you know, we were dead set on it taking 3 months, and we really thought that it was only going to take 3 months, but we should have factored in the fact that this is a new art team and we're really just getting to know each other, where George would know what I wanted. And there's a lot more back and forth. There's some changes that want to be made because, you know, as a creator, you don't want to put anything out there that you can't live with, and you want it to be perfect. So we're now we're 2 months late on our Kickstarter, and it looks like we'll probably be 3 months late, but it's worth it, you know. And that's what any fans that are listening that are backers, like, I want to apologize, but also explain, when you're working with a new art team, there's things that you need to, you know, you need to fix and you need to tweak to make sure that you're putting the best product out there. And in that process, the creative team is kind of molding together, where each one after that is just going to be easier and more, like, it's going to be more seamless. So, it was, like, again, getting back to it, it was a great experience to meet your creative team. I wish I could meet, you know, Faha Raza, the colorist, and I would love to meet HDE. I would love to just sit down and have a drink with him, because, I mean, if he talks as much in person as he does in emails, then, you know, I could just sit back and listen. But,
well, and if he's from England, he probably drinks.
He's a man of many letters.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, it is. It's a great experience to meet your creative team and not just have that, you know, over the phone or text messaging relationship, but to try to spend that time with each other to get to know each other.
Now, growing up, I mean, obviously you've talked about your passion. You've, you know, wanted to start writing comic books, and you're talking kind of through your writer's block and all that. But, like, when did you first fall in love with the medium? Like, at a young age, at, you know, local store, or where did you get into comics?
There was a store called Comic Relief that was within biking distance of my house.
Great name for a comic book store.
Yeah. I'd go there every weekend. You know, I'd be going over to the comic book store, and you just go through, and comic shop. And you'd just go through all the back issues, and, you know, you knew, like, you know, you had the new comic, like, you know, you'd school. So, I mean, I'd never get over there on a Wednesday, but on the weekends you could go back over and you could get the new comics that came out. And I loved the X-Men. I read X-Men and Spider-Man religiously. And, you know, I remember when they had the Inferno series, mega series came out. I mean, I read everything. I read X-Factor, you know, New Mutants, X-Men. It was just, I loved how that whole mega series just spread across the Marvel universe. And I think it always made me think, like, I want to create my own universe. Like, that I can do that too, that I can, you know, have one thing happen here and it ripples into a story over here. So I love the idea of storytelling. So I think at a very young age, I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to, you know, you think to yourself, I want to be a comic book artist, and I'm going to write and draw my own comics. And you're like, yeah, that can happen, until you find out that you suck at both.
I
couldn't draw for anything. I have drawings. I think my mom probably still has them, like, in a hope chest. But all the characters that I would draw looked exactly like X-Men, just changed a little bit and had a little bit different names. But, you know, I had a guy that had blades coming out of his fist, you know, and, you know, I had a guy that, you know, was totally metal. And it was just like, you had no creativity as a kid. And, you know, and if that ever affected me, I'd be like, oh, God, like, I just have, like, I can't do this. But then it was also the drawing. I'm like, I can't draw for shit. So as my, you know, as I grew and, you know, took English classes and went to college and everything, I was like, okay, the art aspect of it. I mean, I took art classes in college, and that's when you really were like, I got to let this go. I got to stop. It's not happening. And because it is, it's something you can't learn. You know, you can't learn how to be an artist. You either have the skills and you could be refined, or, you know, you're not an artist. So that's when I was like, okay, now I got to focus on the writing And comic books kind of fell away from me. I was reading so many novels, and you know, and you're like, I want to be a novelist. So I kind of got away from the comics. And then it wasn't until later that, you know, you kind of revisit that old love that you had for that. And it's almost like you realize, like, it was there all the time. It never went away. You know, it just lay dormant in the back of your mind. And now when you're in it, you're like, holy shit, like, I am really in this. And it's awesome. I mean, I remember the first time I went to Boston Comic Con, probably 4 years ago, and I had a script. I didn't even have any artwork done. And I remember thinking, like, I'm going to find an artist. I'm going to go to Artist Alley. I'm going to give an artist this script, and they're going to love it. And they're going to want to do it for free. So many people, like, you're laughing because you probably heard this a million times, right? Because I hear it. I hear people say, they're like, oh, no, I have the script. And if I could just find an artist to read it, they'll love it, and they'll do it for free. And it's like, yeah, well, if you find that artist, can you tell me his name? I have a few scripts that I want him to read, too. But, you know, and it's amazing, though, now, when I look back, like, some of the people that I went up to and I talked to who, you know, I was nobody. I was the guy who just had a script. And talking to them, like, I'm pretty good friends with now, and I've grown into that. And I didn't really have anybody really helping me along or teaching me the ropes and everything. So that's one of the reasons I do videos now on my Facebook. That's one of the things I use with Facebook Live, is I try to come up with a subject to be like, okay, this is something that if when I was starting out, I would have loved to have been able to sit down with somebody and talk to them about this, and they could have just given me, like, these are the facts of it. And then I could have taken it and gone and ran with it and had a little better understanding of what the process is of creating comics. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do now, is to give back to people that are just coming up in the industry that need, you know, that think like that they can just take a script to an artist and that they'll do it. Like, and I know that there are some people out there that have that. Kelly Bender, who does Starburn, and he's worked with Nathan Kelly on Snarl. He's got a great knack for, you know, writing a script, talking to an artist, and saying, like, hey, listen, we're going to co-create this. Not a lot of people can do that. I'm not somebody who can do that. What I do is I want to find an artist that fits the story that I'm doing. I believe that if you have a script, there's a certain style that probably fits it and a certain style that doesn't fit it. But I wanted to let other people know that, like, you know, it's a misconception that you're going to be able to find an artist that's just going to work for you for free. You know, you're going to have to figure out a budget, and, you know, and then marketing it. How to use social media as a marketing and promotion tool. It's free. So these are just little things like that I've tried to do in a Facebook Live session to kind of give back to people that are just coming out. And I feel like people have responded well, and it's, you know, it's something that would have been helpful for me had it been out there.
Now, with all that being said, is there any, are you reading any books right now?
Right now, I mean, I'm reading Punisher Max. I love reading Garth Ennis's Punisher, partially because one of my life goals is to write the Punisher for Marvel. But he's definitely one of my favorite characters. I love the grittiness of him, and I thought that Garth Ennis did a great job writing him. The other would be the Hawkeye series is amazing. And one of the things that impresses me the most with that is that it's a character that nobody really gives a shit about, you know. And it was like, I read, I don't know if anybody's ever read, I've drawn a blank, but it was Jeff Loeb. It was like the first thing that Jeff Loeb wrote for DC Comics was Challengers of the Unknown. When he first started writing for DC Comics, you know, he said, he was like, I thought I was going to come in there and I was going to be, you know, doing Superman. And they give me Challenges of the Unknown. Like, nobody's ever heard of Challenges of the Unknown.
Yeah, this is the first time hearing of it, too. So,
yeah, but he wrote Challenges of the Unknown Must Die. So what he did was he went to a comic book shop that he goes to all the time. And he told him, he's like, look, I just got hired at DC Comics. They're giving me Challenges of the Unknown to write. So guy went in the back and just, he was like, for $10, this guy just gave me a box full of Challenges of the Unknown. He's like, I went home and I read all of them. And then he wrote this series, Challenges of the Unknown Must Die. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for years.
Oh, wow.
So, like, that, and that's, like, when I look at, you know, what Matt is doing with Hawkeye, it's like, okay, you got, you know, they brought you in. They're not going to give you Wolverine. They're not going to give you Punisher. They're going to give you a character that they probably are like, hey, if you suck at it, well, nobody's reading Hawkeye anyway. So, but he did such a great job with it, just like Jeff Loeb did such a great job with it. And it makes you think, like, if you can successfully write and you can take a character and you can do it uniquely, you could take any character. It doesn't matter if people are reading it or not. If you write it well, then people are going to read it. Then it's going to be word of mouth, and people are going to like pass it around, and it's going to become a thing. And you just taking pride in like your in writing, and you know, you can't just sit back and be like, I fucking hate this character. You just got to be like, all right, well, I need to know this character now, and now I need to love this character, and then I need to make other people love this character. So that's one of the things I'm reading now, is I'm reading Hawkeye, because that, you know, that level that he writes it with is to making it his own thing and to bring that character back up to being something other than a sub character really impresses me. Punisher, I love Punisher, and I just always, Garth Ennis is a, he's a, you know, somebody I really admire as a writer.
Yes.
And then East of West, Jonathan Hickman, I think whenever I read anything that Jonathan Hickman writes, I feel like a total fucking hack. And I feel like I shouldn't even be writing, but you know, he's another one that, so basically I'm just reading a lot of comic books.
Nice. So
there was one time my wife came into the room, somebody had recommended me read Wonder Woman, and it was like the first, like when with the new 52.
Oh.
And my wife came into the bedroom, and I'm laying in bed reading Wonder Woman, and she was just like, you gotta be kidding me. And I'm like, this is my life now.
There's one or two things that could have been going through her mind at that moment, yeah. But those are not for polite discussion. So did you do Volume 1, both parts of Volume 1 on Kickstarter?
The only ones I did on Kickstarter, I did... what did I do on Kickstarter? I did Issue 3 and Issue 4 on Kickstarter. I did Issue 1 and Issue 2 I did myself. And then I learned about Kickstarter. I did Issue 3 and Issue 4... And then this, you know, the beginning of Volume 2 I did on Kickstarter as well.
So do you find that using Kickstarter has helped the creative process? Or do you think that it added, like, more expectations to you as a writer?
Well, I mean, I think that doing a Kickstarter, I look at it as a pre-sale. You know, I don't really load up the price on it. I just look at it as this is a way to distribute. But also, when you have all these people backing your product, and backing it, you know, it's definitely more pressure on you to give them something that is impressive and like in that they love and that they want to come back for more, and that they're like, you know, I don't mind the fact that I, you know, put money into bringing this, you know, bringing this series to light and bringing it out. And because you figure somebody buys your comic book off a shelf, you know, they pay $3.99 or whatever the price is. If they like it or they don't love it, they're like, well, you know, I picked it up off the shelf, and you know, I won't do it again. When you have somebody backing your product on Kickstarter, you know, they're basically saying like, you know, I want to help you bring your dream to life. So now I feel like it's my responsibility to really do the, you know, 100% on this, not just for myself, but for the people that are backing it, because they could do anything with their money. And there's so many different Kickstarters that they could, you know, put their $15, $20, $25 towards, but they decided to put it towards mine. So now it's my responsibility to knock their socks off and be like, hey, you know, when they get it, they're like, I don't even, you know, that $25 was totally worth it. So I definitely think that it amps up your creative process, and it makes you feel more responsible to making a good story and to building good characters, because it's something that, one, you want them to come back for the next one. You know, you want them to tell other people about it. So it's, yeah, I definitely think that it enhances your responsibility to putting out something quality.
So what do you think the future holds for this book? Where is it going? How long do you see it going?
Well, right now, I mean, next month, I try to always keep like little goals. Next month, I hope we get Volume 1, Part 1 out, or Volume 2, Part 1 out. And then, you know, I would like to do my next Kickstarter to get Part 2 out, which it's all ready to go, and you know, we've the creative team is amped, and they're like, okay, we know what we did wrong, we know how to get it out faster, and I have everything written for the end of volume three. So and there's, you know, each volume there's, you know, a new villain, the stakes are raised, and hopefully by the end, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but hopefully by the end of volume three, you know, people like this is now, you know, closer to being a household name. I obviously I would love to see it as a cartoon series on Cartoon Network.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you, I want to play this as a fucking video game. Like the whole time I was reading it, I was like, I want to play this on a console right now.
And you know, and I have notes on I have notes on board games, on video games. Like, I mean, I really what my dream for this is. Is it for to be up there with Star Trek and Star Wars? Like, I want this to be I want to create a universe. And that's, again, like when I first started doing this, my big picture was that this isn't just a story about four characters on a salvage ship. This is about a universe that, you know, we're following not just salvagers, we're following, you know, I have in volume two, we're going to meet a guy who is a delivery guy. He works for Merrill Logistics. And Merrill Logistics is the leader in interstellar transports. And again, the series isn't about rebels and empires and all that. It's about blue collar workers and how they are in that universe and how they interact in that universe and what their goals are for themselves in that universe. So that's my goal, is to build this into something bigger where you could be watching it on Cartoon Network. I would love there to be a movie for it, video games, board games. You know, go into a Toys R Us and you can buy action figures. So that, you know, it's a limitless possibilities that are in my mind. It's just the pot, you know, what I can produce, you know, and the time that I have.
Right on. So you need to send your script to Joss Whedon. But here at Drunken Comics, we have one very important question that we ask all creators. What do you drink with this book? Jameson, he was quick on that.
I prepped him.
Yeah, Jameson on the weekends, you know, Malbec or Pinot Noir during the weekdays when you're just kind of hanging out on the couch. But yeah, Jameson is my, you know, if anybody's sending me a birthday present or anything, bottle of Jameson, perfect.
So why does it go with this book?
Well, I mean, this book is it's gritty. It's, you know, it's hard to swallow. It's you know, when I look at Bill Ronick, like Bill Ronick he's whiskey, you know, he's scotch. He's that stuff that, you know, he wants to get shit faced and he doesn't want to candy coat it. He's not drinking now. He's not drinking some fruity drink. It's, you know, and all the characters are like that. You know, as we go along with this story, you're going to see that, you know, they all have checkered pasts, and you know, they're all kind of not recluses, but they're on that ship, you know, salvaging what's left of their lives too. You know, they're not just out there working on, you know, taking pieces of ships out there. They're out there kind of, this is the end of their life. This is the, you know, the what they've been dealt and what they've done to themselves, and this is their last chance at redemption. This is their last chance to make a buck and try to kind of, you know, just disappear in the galaxy and, you know, not have to face the reality of the choices they made. And when I think of that, I always just, I think of some smoky little hole in the wall bar where, you know, the bartender comes up and you tell him, you know, Jameson, leave me the bottle.
Ah, yes. We've all been there.
Yeah.
Awesome. So tell everybody where, if they want to catch up on Salvagers, where to find it.
Well, right now you can go on Facebook. It's, again, it's, if you put in Salvager Series, all one word, you'll see our little black and white logo come up. And if you go on there, right at the top, I have it pinned to the top, you can click on a link. It's an issue link where we have issues 1 and 2 are free. It's not even down, you don't even have to download it. It's, they're right on a website where you can click on it and you can flip through it just like it's a page, and you can read issues 1 and 2 for free. And then right in there as well, we have the link for Comixology where you can download, you can purchase and download issues 3 and 4. And then, you know, again, next month, we have 4 pages left to do in volume 2, issue 1. So hopefully that'll be out next month. And you can find us also on Instagram, Salvager Series. And if you look up Bob Sally, you know, you'll probably see a guy standing there with a little soy sauce shirt. That's me.
Or a realtor. Yeah. There's a realtor too.
you can contact me there. I'm always available. You know, sometimes it drives my wife nuts that, you know, I have multiple conversations with people that I don't know, but I always try to make myself available to talk to fans or anybody who's an aspiring creator, asking questions. I'll answer it the best I can. And yeah, we're on Comixology. If you go to if you need your comic in print, you can go to salvagers.bigcartel.com. And I sell everything there for print, some posters and T-shirts and all that stuff. And I sign it and ship it right to your door.
Awesome. Well, there's no reason for people not to hop onto this book. Plus, it's amazing.
It's very good.
I appreciate that. Yeah, and I mean, each issue, I mean, I think as any creator would tell you, each issue, the writer, me, I'm always trying to top what I did the last issue. And just like the artist, I mean, I think any artist that does a comic book, they're always trying to, you know, top what they did on the last one. So, you know, hopefully when you read it, you'll see that progression and that that level of, you know, production value go up with each issue. And it's definitely going to go up for the next issue that's coming out next month.
All right. Well, Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks for having me on.
You can find Drunk on Comics on Facebook at our website, drunkoncomics.com. as well as listen to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Points of Interest Podcast Network, as well as Podcast Detroit Network.